नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स नमो तस्स भगवतो अरहतो सम्मा सम्बुद्धस्स बुद्धं धम्मं संघं नमस्सामि। Thursday night, I've never experienced this kind of ice before. It's curious how it's so beautiful and yet so dangerous, isn't it? It's like the world. In Thailand, I just went there just to become a monk, and for some curious reason I was inspired with the whole idea, and I didn't know any Thai, but I knew there was a Western monk somewhere in Chiang Mai, so I went to the travel bureau in Bangkok and asked, where's Chiang Mai, first of all, and how do you say Western monk? So, one of my first words in Thai was Western monk. And so I went up to Chiang Mai, and then it took me 3 days, and I said Pratharang, 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 until finally I found a Western monk. And then he took me back down to Bangkok, and I eventually became a samaner. And then I didn't get any training in Bangkok because sometimes in Thailand it's very slack, and they'll kind of, especially if you're a Westerner, they're just going to take you in, put you in the robe, and then just shove you out in the street kind of thing, which is a disaster. And so I got training, a little bit of training in meditation, but nothing in what it meant to be a samanera, all the rules and so on. And then I went up, my teacher took me up to Ubon, and we visited Ajahn Chah up there. And I liked the feel of the place, and I asked him if I could stay. And he said the food isn't very good. That was his answer. And I found out it was awful. But so I arrived there. I had to leave and come back. But anyway, I hadn't met Ajahn Sumedho yet, and I had heard of him. And one day I was sitting in the eating hall, and among the forest monks, there's this kind of conceit about this color of robe. So those city monks, they wear these kind of bright orange robes, you know, they're kind of fluorescent orange, and you need sunglasses to look at them. So there's this kind of in-group conceit that, you know, hey, you know, we're the forest monks. So especially when you're a young monk, you know, you take on this silly stuff just because one feels so insecure, probably. One day this huge American walked in, and he had these kind of bright red robes on. And I was this kind of young samanera, I said, oh, look at that guy. He's just a city monk. And then that was Ajahn Sumedho. And he had been in he'd just been on pilgrimage in India, and his robes wore out, and he just took what was given in India. That kind of bright color is the color for Swami, and he's got a good sense of humor, so he thought he'd wear it, and into this kind of forced monk setting, and just kind of push the brown row buttons, as it were. It's really cool. But it was such a good insight into perception, you know, into bias and prejudice and bigotry and all that the human mind can get into. Because I looked at him with my kind of adolescent whatever and said, yeah, you don't know anything. I was very embarrassed by that. But where I'm leading with this is interesting. This was his Ajahn Sumedho's 5th year as a monk. And in our tradition, after 5 years, if our teacher thinks that we're kind of sufficiently grounded in the teaching and the discipline, we can go wandering. We can go seek out other teachers or just live in different kinds of situations. And so in Thailand, it's traditional after 5 years for a monk to go wandering, to, especially the forest tradition, either to just kind of go walk about from village to village and living in the rice fields or forests, whatever forests are left, and collecting alms food in the morning, and then meditating during the day and walking on, which is a very rugged, it's a very kind of tough physical practice to do that. I haven't had much of that chance, really. I've done a little bit. Anyway, Ajahn Sumedho was in Thailand, and he ended up in Calcutta, and you know we don't use money, so he managed to sort of for 5 months just to travel around India without any money, and then it came time for the rains retreat, which is the monsoon season in India, and that's a traditional time for monastics to stay in residence for 3 months, which is a rule that comes from the time of the Buddha, that the monks were tended to disturb crops, and it wasn't a very good time for travel, so the Buddha encouraged them to stay in residences. And this is the beginning of monastic life in Theravada Buddhism. Before that, there was just a wandering tradition of shamans and all kinds of different religious seekers. So that was the beginning of monasticism. Ajahn Sumedho then in India, he was thinking, well, where should I stay? What should I do? Should I go back to Thailand? I think he was staying with Muktananda at the time. And it hit him. He said, I should be back helping Ajahn Chah. He had this incredible uprush of gratitude. And he said that was one of the most transformative kind of experiences in his practice. And so he went back to Thailand, and you know, he said, Ajahn Chah, how can I help? And Ajahn Chah really didn't ask for much, but he said that was really a very big shift in his practice. And that's interesting, because quite often we think a big shift in our practice is going to be some, you know, enlightenment experience, as it were, which sometimes it is. But that kind of shift, where the world is no, where meditation or the spiritual life is no longer my seeking and experience for myself, but rather something, an attitude of surrender to life with gratitude and a sense of offering to the beings around me, that kind of shift. I suppose you call it the bodhisattva shift or something like that. And, you know, this kind of sectarian views of Hinayana and Mahayana and all that nonsense that goes on in Buddhism, you know, our arahant selfish and this embarrassing kind of stuff that goes on. Obviously, you know, if one is still seeking something for oneself in terms of experience, then that can't be the path. And somehow all those devotional qualities of gratitude and devotion, and these are, I think, tremendously important for the heart aspect of the practice, because the practice of awareness and self-inquiry can really dry up. It can become this kind of awful, barren space of, yet again, I have to look at my mind. And then you just can't really sustain that in any, and because we have hearts, and giving and generosity, and those are an important part of the spiritual life. And this is very ordinary, really. It's nothing spectacular. But it is fundamental, I think. For me, it is, to the spiritual life. I've been suggesting the use of language as like using Byron, your example of dropping a pebble into a pond, and you kind of, you get the ripples of a pond. There's a nice way of looking at it. I'm just taking an idea and then using the language, words, to drop that idea into consciousness and let that form a kind of mirror of reflection. One of the things I was saying to some people today, I did for a couple of years of practice, I used infinite patience, boundless compassion. Just did that for 2 years. I mean, I did other things too. I ate. I got angry. I did all kinds of other things, but just as a kind of, you know, how you can do that. You can take language and use it, you know, very skillfully by making a suggestion to the mind. And I keep emphasizing this, as opposed to using language to tyrannize yourself. Very Dhamma, you must be patient, and you must have infinite patience, and you will be compassionate. You know, which is the tyranny of idealism and the foolishness of the willful ego mind. But to use language as a suggestion then creates a whole kind of reflective atmosphere, doesn't it? Infinite patience, boundless compassion. And then one notices impatience and modes of cruelty or selfishness. And in the noticing of that, it's awakening. And when I awaken to that, then I have an option. I can follow that or not follow that. But at least I'm fully awake to that. And I found that really helpful, just doing that. And again and again and again, I had a note on my door, and I kind of plastered all over the place, and I just keep throwing it up into consciousness. And these things become mechanical very easily, and then one invents something else. You know, so then I would invent something else. This way of using language, of using suggestions, of using concepts is what we call samasankappa, or the way I see that, the second part of the Noble Eightfold Path, right thought or right attitude. Or like I've been saying, kind of the idea of coaching, suggesting. In the language of the Pali scriptures of Theravada Buddhism is a language of the mind, really. It's really geared towards, it's an ancient language. It's like a Sanskrit language. It's no longer used. There's a few Pali scholars that can talk with each other, but it's not really conversational stuff. But it is a language that has tremendous. Its whole emphasis is the mind and the spiritual life, as opposed to say English, which has, you know, maybe English is a very rich language, but you know, its emphasis maybe is more technology or commercial things or whatever, but it's a very rich language. And so one finds through in the Pali language all these very, very skillful ideas, skillful suggestions that when we look at that, we're sort of reminded of the factors of the spiritual life. And one of these ideas is hiriyotapa, which is it has to do with remorse, and it's defined as a fear and dread of acting in ways which are say immoral and unskillful. Now this fear is not the fear of retribution in the sense of a lightning bolt hitting me, but it's more the just knowing when you put your hand in the fire, your hand's going to burn. If you walk off the edge of the cliff, you break your neck. It's that kind of fear and dread, right? And I know fear and dread is not a kind of good language because it kind of smacks of hell and you know, all those images we have, and then religion just goes into fear. So the only reason I do good is because I'm afraid of punishment. Well, that's not the real point of it in that sense. It's just through experience one does get a sense of this is dangerous. This is dangerous to do this, a sense of danger. And that has to do with remorse, with cause and effect. If we are attendant to the flow of consciousness and we observe cause and effect, you know, we feel the results of our intentions and actions. And those things which are unskillful in action, speech and thought give us painful results. And the pain is minor or major. And if we are willing to listen to that, especially something like remorse, because remorse is a tremendously important teacher. You know, a whole sense of conscience and remorse. Without remorse, we're monsters, aren't we? You know, you have an Eichmann or someone like that, totally remorseless, functioning from some kind of efficient cruelty. You know, it's horrible. So without remorse, we're not really human. In Thailand, in the spiritual part of Thailand, they would say that someone who doesn't keep the five precepts is not human. You might have a biped that can speak good Thai, but they're not necessarily human. It's only when they keep the five precepts that they're human. Remorse, then, is the kind of feeling we get when in some way we've functioned away from truth, in a way which harms other beings or harms ourselves, when we say things which are insensitive, and when we act in ways which go against our aspirations for truth, when we, you know, the different ways that we can feel remorse. Now, the trouble with remorse, it quite often goes into guilt, which is a waste of time, which is actually a kind of lost opportunity. When remorse goes into guilt, what we do is we create an ego around it, a self around it. We take remorse personally, which is it's better than not having remorse, certainly. You know, when you feel remorse and then you punch the guy again, I mean, that would be worse. but when remorse goes into guilt, then we're not really conscious of remorse. And what I found in my life, when my mind gets caught up with guilt, it's kind of, for me, it seems like I'm avoiding the pain of remorse. I don't really want to look at it, so I flagellate myself, and that feels good. You know, to beat myself up kind of feels, yeah, that's appropriate. But there's something very painful about remorse, you know, feeling like if I said something to someone which was kind of just because I'm dumping my stuff on them, or I've manipulated them or whatever, and then I get the result of that, I realize what's happened. Just that feeling of remorse is unpleasant, especially the more you meditate, you know, the more you become sensitive to cause and effect, the more you're reflecting on life. It's really quite, you notice it very, very strongly, don't you? And like we were saying, the kind of instant karma is going to get you. The more you practice, the more you just notice things, don't you? Which is the unfortunate part of our life. But it's also the fortunate part, because it really wakes you up. You know, some beings will do things and then notice it 20 years later, but not really connect. Not really know. But when one lives the spiritual life, the results become very quick, very, very quick. You see it very quickly. And that's very fortunate, because one is seeing cause and effect. With this, there is that. With the arising of this, there's arising of that. Remorse, then, if it's really listened to, and one feels the awfulness of that, or the unpleasantness of that, registers in the mind a sense of hiriyotapa, a sense of when you do this for your dhamma, when you act in this way, you get this kind of result. And that is what makes us more mindful. We become more wary of moving in directions which are painful to ourselves and others. It hurts too much. If we take that remorse, then, and we go into that and feel that, and then we can use language. We can use a language like, first of all, with this there is that. With this kind of speech, there's this kind of result. Now feel the result. This is the result. Guilt would be, oh, you're a terrible person, you said that again. Why did you say that? Now never do that again. I'm never going to say that again. Which is, again, taking it personally, not seeing cause and effect. And that tends to make one more heedless. That is being heedless. Because it's a form of aversion. It's not a form of compassion. And so after kind of a period of self-flagellation, and then kind of saying, I'll never do that again, one does it again. And one is in the same pickle again. And then there's the same pattern of, oh, why did I did it again? I lost it again. God, why do I keep doing this? I'm never going to do this again. I'll never do it again. And one does it again. And that's dumb. You know, cause that's what we call, like in Thai, they say, pit pen kru, mistake is teacher. And the question is, how many times do we have to put our hand in the fire? You know, you put your hand in the fire, you take it out, it's black. Interesting, it hurts. You know, I wonder why. And you put your hand in the fire, and why does it hurt? Listening to remorse, then we can use language to encourage awareness, to encourage wakefulness. Then we can say things like, try to be aware of the arising of this tendency next time it comes up. Now that I can do, that's compassionate. Try to awaken to language which is manipulative, or language which is a put-down, or language which is gossipy, or action which is heedless in some way. Try to awaken to how that begins in the mind. That we can do. And that's not like an ego statement. It's more like encouraging a more continuous mode of mindfulness and wakefulness, a more constant vigilance, constant awareness. And I found, if I can combine those two, I combine the pain of inappropriateness in whatever way that manifests, feel that fully, that registers strongly as a kind of memory. When you do this, you get that. See? It's just cause and effect. It's just nature. This is the Dharma of acting in a certain way. See? When you do this, you get that. And then the suggestion, awaken, awaken, awaken to that particular habit. Then what happens, especially, I think, around like some, you know, some things just overwhelm us, don't they? We have very good intentions maybe to act in wholesome ways, but the power of our fears or the power of our annoyances or just the power of a situation overwhelms us, and we find we're in it again. And our, you know, question we often ask ourselves, well, how do I do this? How do I awaken to this insidious habit that exists in consciousness? And this is one way to do that, to continually see that the path has to be one of awakening. It can't be one of just repressing. The path has to be compassionate. So self-hatred and guilt aren't really compassionate. It has to be responsible, so complacently just saying, well, I'm just that way, I just tend to dump on people, and, you know, that's just the way it is. That's not going to get you free. That's going to keep the remorse going. If one combines those two, then I think what we find is we tend to awaken more quickly. And this is one of the ways they talk about samasati, the right mindfulness. It's like a quickness of recollection, the ability to awaken more quickly and more constantly and more continually. Because that's the problem, isn't it? We fall asleep, or we get kidnapped, or we get immersed in unfortunate states of mind. And so the problem is not so much those habits, because that's the way they are. The mind's been conditioned that way. But rather to awaken to them, and then to not buy into the unwholesome tendencies, not to buy into them. And of course, I think what I find in that way of practicing is that eventually one sees the whole scenario. One sees the tendency to want to speak, act, think in unskillful ways. It arises. You see the causes of that. And the tendency to grasp it and get caught up into it. But there's enough strong mindfulness is that one sees it fully, and it still feels like that, and the mind wants to go that way. One doesn't grasp it, and it begins to cease. And that's when you really see the kind of ending of these habits more and more. You see them really, you see the whole structure begin and end. And there's a kind of joy in that, isn't there? There's a kind of joy to see a pattern coming up into the mind, the tendency of wanting to grasp it and saying, I know you, Mara. I mean, I've grabbed you so many times, I am not going to buy into you. That's not repression, that's refusal. It's a refusal to suffer, I guess, a refusal to suffer. Repression would be kind of not noticing that and trying to shove it away. One, like, quite often, I like to talk about the extremes, right? So one would be indulgence, one would be repression, but restraint. Restraint is possible. Sometimes people kind of have a naive notion or a simplistic reductionist notion that anything you feel you have to express in some way. So you get that kind of pillow-punching mentality, you know, that every time I feel some aggro, I have to punch a pillow. But what's the consequence of that is that every time I feel aggro, I have to punch a pillow. that's the karma. So, then you just become a pillow puncher. So where's the end of that? There's no cessation. Certainly, if I think, you know, I'm a real sweetie and I'm just boiling with anger, someone's maybe got to show me how to punch a pillow, okay. But once things are conscious, it's just not to attach to them. Not to attach to them. And we can do that. We can practice restraint and still fully know an unwholesome tendency. I can feel aversion to someone, fully feel that and not dump my stuff on them. And why do I not dump my stuff on them? Because I know that the consequences for me will be suffering. I get burnt. And so it's not just like me saying, oh, I shouldn't do that. Be a good boy now, Viradhammo. It's more like, this is dangerous. Do this and it'll hurt. And so there's a kind of trade-off. Because we do, you know, we follow things because there's a certain kind of profit in them. We dump our stuff on people because it feels good. For a little bit. it's good to kind of blast someone every now and then. You get the anger out. But then the consequences are very complicated. Or whatever patterns we have. And so the patterns of delusion then becomes unacceptable because we've seen the consequences. We've seen the remorse. We've seen the pain. And this is kind of really understanding suffering. You know, the kind of really listening to that, the causes of suffering in our lives. This takes continual awareness, and it takes this kind of compassion to feel to feel the suffering of one's own conditioning and habits. One of the ways that like freedom and liberation is talked about in Theravada Buddhism is through the kind of ending of the asavas, and asavas is a word which is hard to translate. It's the kind of tendency for the mind to flow outwards in various deluded ways. It's like when some difficulty in the future arises, some problem about some future, then the mind starts to flow in the ways of anxiety. So the future button is pressed, the future is unsure, just anxiety, just flowing out of the mind. Then maybe the technology button is pressed, and there's the desire for a better video, and the kind of greed mind is pressed, and so the mind flows outwards. They say outwards through in these kind of unskillful ways, and we find that, don't we? You just find your mind just going on and flowing outwards, and one of the ways we talk about liberation is where these outflows have ceased. There's this purity of heart, and the mind isn't just reacting. And then there's another we call anusai, which is kind of latent tendencies. There are sort of tendencies, or just, let's say, habits to flow in a certain direction. And we all have that. And we all have these sort of kind of predicaments. And then the challenge is to see the arising of habit, to no longer believe in it until it isn't, and to no longer feed it, really. That's the important thing, to no longer feed it until it ceases. The corollary of that is that if we don't notice the habit, and if we feed it, then we strengthen this tendency to flow outwards. So not, say, like in terms of, you know, the sort of button-pressing images, the more I react to those buttons, the kind of more I have of those buttons, and the more quickly those buttons are released, as it were, the more it happens. So there's a kind of compounding of interest. The more I get angry, the more I have a tendency to get angry. The more I whinge, the more I have a tendency to whinge. The more I follow anxious, worrying thoughts, the more I tend to follow worrying and anxious thoughts. It takes less and less to trigger it off until, finally, there's no freedom. There's absolutely no space. And it's interesting to watch, say, people who have not cultivated mindfulness of thought, mindfulness of habit, awareness of habit, how they have no freedom, because they just automatically go into these modes of worry or aversion or fantasy. You know, their mind is completely enslaved to habit, and that's very sad to see. And you see that. You see someone is really not here. They're just in these endless habits, and that's that's the result. And seeing that and witnessing that, one has this kind of urgency. Not kind of urgency of greed, but the urgency to wake up. To really wake up. You know, this is what the Buddha is saying. He said, come on, wake up. This is dangerous. It's like an ice storm. Be careful. Wake up. And that's what the word really means, wake up. I find that there's a balance between just kind of getting neurotic about these things. Because when you're talking to someone, oh God, oh no, what's going to happen? You know, there's that. But then there's also the complacency, isn't there? Say, well, you know, they say it takes 20,000 lifetimes, so what the hell? Have another beer. You know? Go for that. One has to consider one's own personality. Obviously, so if I tend, you know, any kind of talk about that, you know, just gets me into the sort of fear of retribution and hell and all of that awful kind of mind state, then that's maybe not skillful. Another person who, you know, who's very complacent, you know, needs a kind of bit of kick in the ass, maybe that's helpful. So these are kind of just suggestions. And again, these ideas are really just strategies. They're not kind of ultimate truths, and each of us has to use the strategies which are appropriate to our own conditioning. No technique is going to do it, and not, like I tend to like to stress more like attitudes, and like the basic conditioning we have, the basic, like, how do I interpret the world, and how do I interpret myself in the world. The kind of basic patterns that I react through, these things which each of us has to see for ourselves. The meditation then can be a kind of calming of the mind, hopefully, and to some extent cleansing, but then the real work comes when those buttons are pressed, you know, in the heat of battle, as it were, in the nitty-gritty of life, when our underlying assumptions are challenged or are these habitual patterns come up into mind. If we make suggestions like I'm going to try to wake up to that, I'm going to try to notice the arising of that, I'm going to try to notice how that the thoughts around that, and we keep doing that, then that makes mindfulness much stronger. And then you have the kind of continuity of mindfulness. Like the story I like to tell, that one I had around a bully, and I wasn't very good with bullies, and these things happen in monasteries too. I mean, I wasn't getting my head beat in, but there was a kind of psychological bully in the monastery, and I just couldn't handle him. So I you know, I kind of, you've probably heard this though, but anyway, I'd spread kindness to him. May you be well, may you be well. Inside I'd say, may you drop dead, may you drop dead. I try to be nice. That wouldn't work. And then I kind of blow it completely and scream at the guy. And he'd love it because he knew he had me, you know, had me by the goat. And I just struggled with this for a long time until, you know, and I just keep, you know, I'd go back to my hut and I'd get really angry with myself. Go, come on, get your act together, come on. but then I say, got to see how does it arise? You know, how does this condition arise? And I just keep making that suggestion until finally I saw, you know, that my, you know, the fear I had for in that situation, how I'd react to the fear, and eventually I could kind of speak through the fear and get over it, understand the fear, and then the fellow knew he had, you know, he couldn't play the game anymore. And I mean, he was lost in his delusion too, so I wasn't helping him at all by my delusion. It was like, you know, the dance of delusion, two beings locked in foolishness. And so when I could surmount my own attachment there and speak strongly but not angrily, then that really helped him in his delusion. But what I'm just trying to indicate is that for me, that particular habit was very strongly embedded in the mind. And, you know, you could give me all the counseling you wanted. You know, it's quite often people give you the theory. The theories are easy. You know, just be aware. You know, just, but when you're in the heat of the moment, it's not so easy because of the power of habit, the power of these kinds of outflows. And the suggestions are, again, to awaken, awaken, awaken. And then, of course, those kind of, which are pretty really breakthroughs in one's own conditioning, then from then on, one has a better handle on that, and the attachment in that particular way has a chance to fall away. Yesterday I was just one more thing before I close. Yesterday I was speaking about conviction and faith and trust, and one of the things I don't think I mentioned was the conviction in enlightenment. Faith in enlightenment, trust in enlightenment. They're like an article of faith in Buddhism is that there are enlightened beings, that the human heart has a very deep possibility. And that we have that possibility too, that our enlightened beings, that's the kind of article of faith. And in a cynical time, and you know, you consider what's gone on in this last century, humanity is, it's done some really awful things. And it's really easy to get terribly cynical about the human condition and think it's hopeless. You know, might as well just get stoned for dead. So it can be very, very negative and cynical in that way. But that you know, the Buddhist practice is an aspiration to a very deep possibility, a very profound possibility. And I think that kind of conviction keeps one going. I certainly have that conviction partially because I've had certain helpful experiences, not that I'm enlightened, but you know, something that just touched me deeply, partially because I've met beautiful beings, and partially because I just know that human beings aren't just kind of grubby, violent monsters. There is that possibility in the human heart. And this is sadha, this is conviction of faith. That the habits of delusion that come up into consciousness is not our deepest possibility. The pettiness and childness of one's emotions are not the ultimate aim of the human experience. You know, that there is something beyond that. And that's quite often kept me going in you know, when I've been through my valleys and all of that. Just that, I mean, I've been very fortunate because I've had good parents, and then I've had two very good teachers, like Ajahn Chah. His example was so helpful because basically I didn't know what I was doing in Thailand. I was just sort of trying to figure out how to do this, and just the example of a wise being, you know, and a being who enjoyed life, who loved life, who had a tremendous sense of humor and compassion, and who just was always acted appropriately in time and place. It's not like he was sort of, you know, kind of drifting on a cloud. He was an earthy man. He used to take out, he had three pairs of false teeth. One was for eating, one was for talking, and one was for chewing betel nuts. And after his meal, he'd take out his false teeth and wash them, which, you know, for Western sensibilities is a bit much. Why not? You know, he'd finish his meal, take out his false teeth, and he'd be talking to people, washing his false teeth. Kind of very real, very natural. And there are, you know, there are those kinds of beings, and my school is called the Way of the Elders, Theravada, as I've been saying on this retreat, our responsibility is somehow to understand Dhamma, and, you know, most of us are elders in society now. You know, most of us are that age, believe it or not. You know, even if you're coloring your hair, you know, it's still. And so, you know, you contemplate what is the responsibility of an elder, and an elder's responsibility is to lead according to truth. And so consider your own path and our own understanding of the difficulties we go through. It is kind of our responsibility, isn't it? You know, what are other, you know, otherwise how is youth to be, you know, where do they have their role models? And one has to be confident with Dharma. And one has to, you know, I find it difficult when elders are led by the fashion of youth. I think that's not healthy for a society. I mean, I love the energy of youth, but when the limited experience of youth leads society, you know, and everyone thinks they have to be 16 again or something like that, I think, oh, that's a disaster. Because certainly it should be that, you know, as we live our lives and we practice Dhamma, that we do understand something, you know, because we've worked on ourselves and we understand deeply, and that we should be able to lead and share in that. So that's the way of the elders, you know, kind of the way of leading society. And again, so that gets down to the difficulties I'm having and the passions I experience. If I am willing to bear with them and learn about them, then that is a tremendous offering to society, isn't it? If I can understand guilt, and I can understand the difference between remorse and guilt, then I can help other beings who have that. It must be, you know, much more important than building yet another fancy way of taking photographs. What a waste of time. Yet another way of making photographs. Or, you know, what's going to happen after CDs? Is it going to be digital? Mm-hmm. To me, it's bizarre, really. You know, you get tape recorders, and then you get, what do you get? We had the, in my day, you had 45s, and you had those big things. And then you get tapes, and then you get CDs, and then, you know, and you wonder, what is the point of that? You know, what is the point of that? So the way of the elders is not consumptive, but it's to take responsibility for one's own predicament, not to blame, to understand it, and then to lead, to share. And I do feel that, you know, wise beings, people go to them, they like to be with them. There is that possibility. And if the youngsters don't listen to you, that's all right too. That's all right, because one, you know, one is done when you're home. Right? So pit pen kru, a mistake of teacher. How many times do we go through the cycles? This is the challenge. But do contemplate when you have functioned in some way which hurts. Really look at that moment. What kind of language do you use for yourself? Do you use language which awakens you, Or do you put, do you use language to put you down? Because if you use language to put you down, it's going to just, it's going to entrench that same predicament into the mind. If you use language for awakening, then that habit has a chance of ceasing. Now these simple things, little things, but you know, over if you just keep working on that, seeing cause and effect, then you just keep awakening, and the delusions have a chance to wear out. All right, I'll leave that for contemplation. Any questions for anyone? Or comments? The craving for enlightenment and? The aspiration.
Right.
Well, if you work with the Four Noble Truths, then non-enlightenment is suffering. So when you're suffering, you know you're not enlightened. Right? So if you... So if you're trying to get enlightened, then you're suffering. Right? So then you go to that. This is a feeling that I'm someone who has to get enlightened. And that's suffering. And if you let go of that, you know, this is a feeling of being unenlightened. That's the feeling. Then you say, I am enlightened. I am.